This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Nadine Sinno about her book titled A War of Colors, Graffiti and Street Art in Postwar Beirut, published by the University of Texas Press, which is a really interesting book, a really colorful in a lot of different senses of the word book. That investigates what sort of graffiti we see currently in Beirut, we have seen over the last two decades or so, because Beirut, I mean, Lebanon in general, there's a lot of politics going on. There's a lot of engagement with politics going on. And a lot of that turns up in graffiti and is encouraged by graffiti. There's all sorts of symbiotic relationships going on. So lots of fascinating things in the book. Nadine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. Currently, I'm an associate professor of Arabic and director of the Arabic program at Virginia Tech. My primary research field is modern Arabic literature and cultural studies. My interests include modern Arabic and Arab American literature, particularly focusing on gender and sexuality, race and ethnicity, and visual culture. I'm also a literary translator from Arabic to English. So why did I decide to write this book? I was born and raised in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. And in 2001, I left to the U.S. to pursue a higher education, which meant, you know, I would spend winters in the U.S. and summers in Beirut. And like many Beirutis of my generation, like my most powerful memories of Beirut's streets consisted of pockmarked walls, posters of political leaders, and logos of militias. So in my mind, Beirut streets have always belonged to militias and their visual markers, and the rest of us residents, you know, simply rush through the streets to get from one place to another. As the years progressed, however, I started noticing new and unexpected types of graffiti, including colorful tags, stencils with like clever social commentary, and murals paying homage to different artists. And the sight of these unexpected portraits, such as those of Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, or the Lebanese singer Fairuz, or the anti-war stencils, they really gave me pause and tempted me to spend more time on the streets. I feel like I started developing a new relationship with my city, and I wasn't in a rush to go anywhere. So the walls touched me, obviously, very personally, but also the cultural studies scholar in me wanted to study them more closely and more critically. I wanted to learn more about my city and its transformation. And also, given the ephemeral nature of graffiti, I wanted to document some of these walls before they disappeared. I hope to write a book and take the reader on a journey where it was the graffiti makers and their walls and not experts and political leaders doing the storytelling, so to speak.
And interesting combinations of reasons that I think very much come through in the finished product of the book. So thank you for giving us that introduction. And I'd love to dive right into kind of the critique and the investigation that you engage with. Starting with, I suppose, the obvious question, how did post-war graffiti develop in Beirut?
As I was saying, I believe we really cannot talk about post-war graffiti without talking about wartime graffiti, because it highly influenced graffiti makers today and motivated them to utilize graffiti in a different manner. So as I was saying, during the war, the various factions, political factions, continued to like leverage dehumanizing and polarizing graffiti, even shortly after the war, as well as political posters as means of sort of marking their territories, intimidating political rivals, and commemorating their leaders. And also Beirut's walls had endured the impersonal touch of urban revival in the post-war era. So this is because reconstruction efforts swept the country and signs of change started appearing, including freshly painted walls, shiny storefronts, striking high-rises. But, you know, as many scholars have pointed out, such changes have been alienating and exclusionary in their own way, often obliterating local histories and perhaps privileging neighborhoods that seemed more worthy of rehabilitation than others. But after the war, around the early 2000s, I think as the country witnessed relative stability, a new generation of young graffiti makers wanted to reclaim the streets by producing community-centered and thought-provoking visual artifacts. These were new forms of graffiti making, which initially took place in the city's alleys and bridges and under their bridges in basically tucked away areas, but they gradually spread into more visible parts of the city. And importantly, I think whereas the early wave of post-war graffiti really resembled Western graffiti, many Lebanese street artists would ultimately like move away from imitating the West, and they would fashion what I consider a more hybridized form of street art that emphasized the city's local color by drawing upon its Arab or Lebanese heritage and without necessarily disavowing Beirut's globalized reality. And I think around, you know, by summer 2014, I became convinced that there was a substantial corpus of work. These were not just isolated pieces. And so I felt that it deserved a systematic investigation. Also importantly is to note that, you know, the production of visual symbols in Beirut, but also in other places, it tends to wax and wane depending on shifting political conditions. So for example, in summer 2015, Beirut's downtown was filled with graffiti about waste mismanagement and toxic politics in the wake of the Houston protests. On the other hand, in 2019, there was another surge of graffiti that voiced people's solidarity and their dissent against the system as a whole, showing us, you know, how art and politics are never separate and always they're porous and they always overlap.
Okay, that's a really interesting kind of foundation, I suppose, for this that I'm going to ask you more questions about to get into in more detail.
Sure.
Starting, I suppose, with the kind of assumption you mentioned kind of having going into this of the streets are about militias and control and they're not places to necessarily stand around and enjoy art. I admit, coming into this book, I was also sort of expecting you to talk about graffiti that was about things like glorifying political leaders or claiming that this political side was better than that one. Mm-hmm. Lebanon, of course, is both known for and does actually have sectarian tensions that come up in a lot of ways. But you talk about in the book that while there is some of that, there is also a new generation of graffiti makers that are trying to shift that discourse away from that being kind of most of what the graffiti is. Can you talk about how they're shifting things and maybe what some of the reactions have been?
Absolutely. So as you rightly mentioned, there is no doubt, and I actually emphasize that in throughout the book, I think, that this new type or new wave of graffiti did not replace old political symbols. I also thought when I first started seeing the murals, oh, it's going to be all about this, you know, very aesthetically pleasing. It's actually not true. A lot of these new type of graffiti, it sits side by side with sectarian symbols. And like during times of election, for example, the political posters also come back with a vengeance. So it does not replace it. I think it competes with it in the production of space. But I do think that we now have sort of more and more actors competing for space, and that the discourse is shifting from being exclusively focused on the glorification of political leaders. And what I want to say is that like different graffiti makers have done different things by means of shifting the discourse. For instance, graffiti artist Yazan Halawani wanted to replace these leadership posters by portraits of renowned singers and journalists because he wanted kids to grow up looking at pictures of artistic role models such as Fairuz and not corrupt politicians. He spoke about delightfully removing politicians' faces so he can create a smoother surface for painting his portraits. On the other hand, during the 2019 protests, graffiti makers actually demonized and mocked political leaders in general. So whereas during peaceful times, maybe graffiti makers were working on scrubbing politicians' faces off the wall to, you know, to put pictures of cultural icons, they re-inscribed their faces during the revolution in downtown Beirut alongside captions that condemned their actions. Other ways of shifting the discourse have been through other means. Some graffiti makers have decided to focus on the environment and to talk about how we can protect a public space and burn fat, not fuel. Other alternative discourses have focused on gender and sexuality. So all these alternative discourses are repurposing and reclaiming the walls, I think, in different but interconnected ways. But what matters is that now the street is not the sole sort of property or sphere of for glorifying political leaders only, if that makes sense.
It does make sense and is really interesting to kind of add complexity to our assumptions that we might have. And in fact, that's, I think, a lot of what you're doing in the book is like, hang on a second, there's more going on here than we might assume. I'd love to turn to another aspect of that, which is discussions around gender, gender identities, sexual identities. What sorts of ways do we see discussions about that showing up in the post-war graffiti landscape?
Yeah, thank you. That chapter is very dear to my heart, the gender and gender and sexuality, because it also surprised me in different ways. But as I said, as some of the examples I already mentioned, female icons started showing up on the spot, showing up in different spots on Beirut streets, competing with these male political leaders. Also, many of them are considered nonconformist or transgressive in one form or another through their self-representation, their public behavior, and their life choices. So among them, for example, is the late singer Sabah, whose controversial persona has, you know, elicited complicated responses among the Lebanese public. Yazan Halwani emphasized when he commented on the Sabah mural that his decision to memorialize her stemmed not only from his desire to celebrate her artistic contributions or beautify the street, but also from his intention to highlight her legacy, which goes beyond performance and entertainment. He actually wrote, I believe it was on his Facebook page, "She was not only an icon. I think we need to take Sabah's thrive in modern society, break taboos when need be, and not be held by norms." So basically what seems like a liability is presented in Yazan's mural as her strength and her legacy. Other types of stencils engage with gender-based violence. One stencil, for example, features the image of the blue bra, a stencil that first appeared in Egypt, and the words Duddan Nizam against the regime, thereby memorializing a female protester who was filmed being beaten and dragged during the protests in Egypt, and whom the media referred to as Lady with the Blue Bra, or at least the Western media referred to her as such, the Arab media as Sitt al-Banat, or the best of all girls, a lady among girls. There are other types of gender and sexuality-related graffiti, including queer-positive graffiti, which aims to construct more inclusive public spaces. So rush scrolls such as "Gay is Okay," "I'm Bisexual," "Queer and Proud," and "Lesbian" have become more widespread in the past few years, and they remind fellow Lebanese and other visitors that gay people do exist in Lebanon and that some hope to express their sexual orientation despite societal taboos.
I guess I want to stay on this topic. I mean, I don't know. I'm glad you said it was near and dear to your heart. This, I don't know if this is my favorite chapter, but it might have been. There is a lot of compelling examples in it. So I wonder if we can stay on it for another question. Because if we're talking about things like women's rights, we're talking about LGBTQ visibility in the Middle East, I think a reasonable part of that conversation is also about, well, what is masculinity? And how is that being modeled and discussed, given how much these things are often considered in opposition to each other? So how can we understand the work of graffiti makers in that sense? Is there modeling of alternative masculinity that's happening here?
Definitely. I think you can come at that question from different ways, and thank you for asking it. I think by highlighting alternative or minoritized, gender identities and subjectivities and sexual practices, these graffiti makers are contributing to deconstructing heteronormative discourses and assumptions about not only masculinities, but also femininities in contemporary Lebanon, showing us that lived realities are really simply more diverse and complex than one might assume about Arab countries. And also by protesting things like sexist Lebanese laws or rape or the violence of language, these graffiti makers, most of whom are men, demonstrate an empathetic and just masculinity that is very highlighted in Western mainstream media, which tends to paint all Arab men and women with broad brush strokes, to use a relative term here. So for me also, like this war of colors that I talk about, and that's a recurring trope among post-war graffiti and street artists, it speaks really to the mindfulness of graffiti makers about constructing and enacting also through the act of graffiti making their preferred version of masculinity and citizenship among the different choices that Beirut offers, including armed and aggressive masculinity. I think this version of masculinity is generally rooted in artistic rivalry, but also rejection of injustice and a commitment to an alternative placemaking.
Which is really interesting, again, to kind of push back against some of these assumptions that we might have. So thank you for telling us a bit about that. I'm glad you included it in the book. I do want to kind of continue this theme, if we can, of adding further complexity to all of this, to really go away from this idea of graffiti kind of only showing one thing. You talk about in the book that graffiti makers also, in addition to everything we've talked about so far, talk about environmental issues and are involved in environmental activism in Beirut, which of course is not just something that graffiti makers are doing. That's happening in other ways as well. So can you talk about kind of the role graffiti has played in environmental activism, how that's showing up, and the sort of symbiotic relationship, I suppose, between these things?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a symbiotic relationship. I at least it appears to me that graffiti has served as a complement or a strategic tool for bemoaning the devastated city that is Beirut, that has witnessed a lot of environmental devastation, right? And also a means of establishing links really between toxic environments and toxic politics, as well as a means of spreading awareness regarding residents' duties and responsibilities towards the environment. So environment-oriented graffiti makers have lamented Beirut's disappearing public spaces and the preclusion of average residents, particularly the working class, from enjoying the little that remains of Beirut's green and maritime spaces. So to that end, some have leveraged stencils as means of protesting privatization and the policing of open public spaces at the hands of political and private sector elites. So as an example, stencils about Beirut's shrinking public park Al-Hurish and Dalia Tarrawshe, one of the last remaining stretches of Beirut's public shoreline, have drawn attention to the Lebanese government's and private sector's usurpation of public space, and also to the efforts of environmentalists and concerned citizens who have refused to go down without a fight. Many of these activists are using graffiti as a means of reminding people, hey, this sea is for you to use. When will the government open the park, they ask. And so graffiti then becomes yet another tool. As you said, it's not the only tool of fighting for people's right to open spaces, of spreading awareness among people, asking them to use bicycles instead of cars, reminding them that, you know, the trees are going to be annihilated if we just keep building highways, and so on. And so I think the environmental graffiti is really, really good also at just like daring us to imagine a different way of being in the world. The women, there's like a series of graffiti pieces on women riding bikes, and it sort of dares us to imagine a city where women are cycling freely, like unhindered by traffic or the fear of social stigma or gendered violence.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Speaking of this idea of kind of the symbiotic relationship or the intertwining of graffiti and activism, can we expand that beyond environmental issues and talk about the 2019 protests? What role has graffiti and street art generally played in helping really sort of brand or solidify or consolidate these protests as not just being sort of a scattering of activism, but really kind of something quite coherent and consolidated?
Yeah, I feel like 2019 really showed or epitomized the use of graffiti as a means of animating resistance and bringing people together, and also reflecting the sort of historical moment where people came together from different factions, ages, socioeconomic backgrounds, sects, and religion in Lebanon in ways that I think are unprecedented, actually. To just give you more concrete examples, there were pithy phrases that showed up throughout the city, reiterating the unity of civilians as one entity and confronting the government elites. So, for example, there were scrolls that would state, "Ya nahna ya henne," which means, you know, it's either us or them, implying that at this point in Lebanon's history, either the government or the people will survive the other. Some of them highlighted the commitment of Beirut residents to support residents in other cities, for example, in Trablus and Tripoli, a devastated city in the north. Among the Tripoli-centered scrolls, for example, were messages that said, you know, "Ya Trablus, nahna ma'ik lil maut," which means, "Oh, Tripoli, we are with you until death," and "Trablus la'ma nbi'a," "Tripoli, we will not sell it." Another, for me, relevant scroll features the image of like two arms clasped, or stencil, two arms clasped together, captioned by the phrase "Sabadudun," which translates to, loosely translates to, like, "together against them." And it may be considered an illustration of the actual 2019 human chain comprised of protesters from areas across the country who held hands to really send a message to the sectarian state that the Lebanese people were actually, in fact, contrary to popular belief, uniting regardless of the religious, sectarian, and socioeconomic affiliations. So there were all these graffiti pieces that wanted to speak of that solidarity, and in an effort to reflect it, but also shape it and encourage people to do more of it, I think.
Very interesting to think about kind of the role that graffiti is playing in creating these identities in some ways, obviously recognizing what's there, but also going, "Hey, look, this is there," and trying to encourage it in that way. I wonder if we can talk about graffiti that is in Beirut, maybe doesn't look like it's about Beirut, but actually, as you show in the book, very much still is. And this is graffiti that is about things happening outside of Lebanon, whether it's other places in the Arab world or the Muslim world or the Middle East, or graffiti that kind of doesn't seem on the face of it to be about something in Lebanon. Can you talk about what connections you nevertheless see to Beirut?
Yeah, sure. So there's a chapter that basically deals with graffiti that engages with issues in the region. And I believe at the beginning of the chapter somewhere, I mention a quote by scholar Marwan Kredi, who actually talks about how, like, how Lebanon is a small and a fractured country that is greatly affected by external political and social forces. And I believe he says that Lebanon is always shaken to the tune of neighborly turmoil. And I think that is really, really revealing and sort of guided the way I thought about this. So the Lebanese crisis and visual culture productions that I describe in the book you know, happened while people across the Arab world were wrestling with unprecedented and enduring political and socioeconomic realities. So like the Palestinian Israeli conflict represents an ongoing struggle in which Lebanon and consequently Lebanese visual culture will always be involved. The Arab uprisings, most prominently in Syria and the ensuing civil war, have also compelled the Lebanese to articulate and enact solidarities and at times hostilities towards their fellow neighbors in various ways, including graffiti making. And I think it's important to keep in mind that Lebanon has been home to for decades to Palestinian and Syrian communities whose presence continues to shape not only like the Lebanese sociopolitical landscape, but also the visual landscape. So it's really no surprise that graffiti in Lebanon would touch upon issues that affect neighboring countries, for example, by inscribing or defacing really slogans and images that summon Palestine, Israel, and Syria, graffiti makers seek to commemorate or obliterate important regional political events to express support or opposition to people and causes associated with neighboring countries, and also to really invite pedestrians to ponder all these sociopolitical events that will that have inevitably affected Lebanon. So mainly these issues include the Arab-Israeli conflict, the dispossession of Palestinians, and the Syrian civil war, among others, which affect the Lebanese in different ways, whether we're talking about, you know, xenophobia or anxieties of sharing resources with refugees, or about articulating solidarity and respect and hope towards, you know, the struggles of fellow Arabs, because ultimately we're all interconnected. And Lebanon is a tiny country that is always, always connected to everything that's happening in the region.
And so framed that way, it's no surprise really that it shows up in the graffiti as well. So thank you for helping us see past the first idea of going, oh, this doesn't seem related. No, it very much is. I wonder if I could ask, I suppose, a bit of a big picture question. There's a number of ways in which I found things surprising and intriguing because of it in the book. I've kind of made mention of it as we've been discussing, but especially given where you started with this of going, hang on a second, there's something here, and literally physically investigating, you know, walking the streets and photographing them yourself. Was there anything in particular in that process or in the kind of writing up of it into this book that especially surprised you?
So thank you for mentioning the walking the streets, because that bit is very important to me. But what I want to say is, so I think I didn't encounter like this one thing that surprised me, but maybe little different things that delighted me and surprised me throughout the journey, if I may. So for example, you mentioned walking the streets. So like I remember one day, for example, being really exhausted and frustrated because I was trying to find that one graffiti that I heard about, one graffito, I should say, by a French-Tunisian artist, but I just couldn't find it, right? And I was feeling discouraged. And as I turned the corner, like ready to head home, I came face to face with the mural of Asmahan by Yazan Halwani, she's a famous Syrian Egyptian singer that my parents really adored. And I just started smiling. I was just so happy to see her. And that would become a theme for me as I like learned to approach the project with more humility. It just allowed me to be more, to allow myself to be more surprised, to not be like that purposeful in my forays into the city. Because if I had not looked up that day, after feeling so despondent, I would have missed that Asmahan wall that brought me a lot of joy, that brought my dad a lot of joy when I showed him the picture. But also thinking beyond the sort of like walking the city, researching graffiti surprised me by actually giving me a chance to bond with my family and friends and with strangers in unexpected ways, right? So my brother, for example, who I mentioned in my acknowledgments, he encouraged me to hop on his moped and roam the city in search of graffiti pieces that were perhaps more controversial than murals. And that demanded that, you know, we got to snap those pictures and get going. It felt like partners in crime. And when my husband was stopped and interrogated on the street, I learned to appreciate his commitment to do this for me, but also his commitment to knowledge and to learning in that he wanted to document the graffiti, regardless of some of those, you know, unpleasant moments. And also zooming out, I was really surprised by like the sheer volume of graffiti in Beirut and the diversity of topics that it covered. It was exciting, but it was also, frankly, very overwhelming. I felt a lot of pressure. I wanted to capture everything, the murals, the stencils, the rushed scrolls, the pretty, the ugly. But, you know, of course, again, speaking of humility and being humbled, I discovered there was no way that I would be able to, you know, represent or find and photograph and analyze every single graffito, and that, you know, I had to trust fellow scholars in also, you know, contributing to this scholarship through their own fieldwork and publications. And then here's where Bakhtin really helped me. His emphasis on unfinalizability, on, you know, ongoing communication among human beings helped me surrender to my limitations and decide it was time to stop and finish the manuscript instead of extending this project summer after summer after summer. And also allowed me to frame the last chapter as in conclusions. That was the only way I could stop, instead of a traditional conclusion, because there's simply no end to a project on graffiti. Just a good stopping point is what I ultimately decided to, you know, to think about it.
I'm so pleased you mentioned that last point in particular, because that was definitely one of the things I thought of, even just reading the title and blurb of your book at the very beginning, was, oh my God, like how that would be such an overwhelming project. I mean, how could one person even do it? And it is something that I think is relevant to a lot of research and a lot of research projects that we do. And so to have such a clear way of thinking about it and to articulate it and to share it, I think is a powerful contribution, kind of regardless of the other content of the book. That in and of itself is a really helpful thing to share. So thank you for adding that to the end of our conversation. And I do have fun mental images of you zooming around Beirut on a moped as well. So I can only imagine what that would have been like. And the partners in crime, you know, I can just imagine like the mood music that, you know, if this was a movie scene, what it would be like. Yeah, exactly. It's so clear then from our discussion, and obviously having had the chance myself to read the book, there's so much cool stuff happening here, and I'm sure there will be other scholarship and work that contributes to it. But I wonder what you might be working on now that you have come to a stopping point on this project. The book is out in the world. Do you have anything you want to preview or highlight?
Yes, but first I want to thank you also for your very supportive and generous reading of the book. I really, really appreciate that. Thank you. And also for asking me, you know, the question about surprises. I hadn't thought about it before, and it allowed me to really think again about all the people who helped make this happen. You mentioned one person. It would be impossible for one person. This would not have happened without the help of my husband, who helped me walk the streets, my brother, who like, let's get on the moped, people who sent me pictures saying, oh, you really need to check this out. You know, police officers who even said, you know, you're not supposed to be here taking pictures near the mosque or the church, but I'm just gonna, you know, turn my head the other direction. So it was really a collaborative work, and in many ways reminded me of the sense of community that I associate with Lebanon and the Arab world in general. So thank you for that question. What's next? So I think, you know, tentatively speaking, of course, I think my next project will be focused on nature-centered texts, films and books that are novels, that or memoirs that explore environmental devastation caused by deforestation, military violence, urbanization, and corrupt leadership. So what I would like to do is analyze, you know, literary and filmic representations of war in cities including Gaza, Baghdad, and Beirut, and, you know, waste management crises, you know, also in cities like Beirut and Cairo. So I also hope that, you know, the next project will explore restorative human nature relationships that, you know, engage us, making us think about our mutual vulnerability and communal healing. But also parallel to this, I'm a translator, as I mentioned. So I'm currently working on co-translating a Lebanese novel by Lebanese author Rashid Daif, tentatively titled The Other Side of the Shadow. So that's where I'm at.
Okay, well, those both sound like very interesting projects. So best of luck with those. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been talking about if you want to learn more. It's titled A War of Colors, Graffiti and Street Art in Postwar Beirut, published by the University of Texas Press. Nadine, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.